did you happen to get aligned with him and do it?
Well, at that time, a very interesting finding had been published by Kergel. And the finding was that there were D amino acids in cancer tissue rather than L amino acids. Now, that was such an exciting thing that everybody, almost in biochemistry, tried to repeat it and find out if that was really true, because that was sensational. Well, it turned out that it was a fraud. I mean, not on Kergel's part, but his technician had done him in. And Lippmann was, among many others, trying to either prove or disprove this thing, and he wanted to do it. I think we did it with isotopes, that's why I came into the picture. He was using enzymatic methods, and I've even forgotten just what the experiment was, but it was a D-amino acid oxidase, and I think it was done either in D2O or something. Anyhow, there was an isotope involved in working this thing out. And nobody, by the way, could confirm Kergel. Now, it was found that in the course of that, by some very careful workers, that when you crystallized some of these, the particular amino acid which he had isolated, I've forgotten, that had more D than in normal tissue, that you did get a slight preference of one isotope or the other, depending on the conditions of crystallization. There was enough difference. But that was true whether you got it from normal tissue or from cancer tissue. So it, at any rate, he never, by the way, Kergel never withdrew that. He didn't believe that his technician had...
that's strange. Really.
Yes,
that's one of the beauties of science, that other people can check your work. And if,
yes, and you know, even though nobody could confirm it,
right,
he wouldn't give in, so I don't know.
That's K-O-E?
K-O-G-L, with an umlaut on the O, Kergel.
Okay.
I remember Dean Burke, who had a flair for language, and at least thought he did, had a seminar which he called Kergelism and Neo-Kergelism.
You also had another paper that did not have Rubinio's name on it. That was with W.H. Fishman. Is that the one that Rubinio would not put his name on?
Yes. Well, I don't know why.
He did a acetylation of...
I know. In fact, that's the... This symposium that I talked at, which we did a joint paper, was on acetylation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why he didn't want to put his name on that, but he didn't. You can't imagine a greater contrast, this is interesting, both men being dead now, between Rubinio and Lippmann. Lippmann was completely intuitive and couldn't tell you how he got to his end result. As though he got it from on high, you know. Rubinio, on the other hand, always pointed out to us, the younger people, exactly every step in his reasoning. But it was...
It was a good atmosphere in which to learn how to do science.
Oh, yes, because he was very explicit, and but Lippmann, even if you questioned him, he couldn't explain to you. He was very inarticulate. But it was during those years that he wrote the famous paper on so-called high-energy phosphate bonds. When he was in Rubinio's lab, Lippmann wrote that paper, which really had a tremendous influence on the field. The whole idea that ATP, for example, and other compounds like phosphoenolpyruvate had special kinds of phosphate bonds, which he called high energy, but chemists would call them low energy. But anyhow.
So you were kind of aware of that kind of thing before you left, or you weren't?
I wasn't even aware of it.
Shortly, I want to find out when your interest in phosphorylation and...
Well, that happened at the Vinyos, when I got to Corey's lab.
Yeah, okay.
And that's when I discovered the Vinyos, Lippmann's paper, because he was very reticent and he did think about a great many things. For example, he said to me one day, why don't you try to see if the methyl group of creatine comes from methionine, you see? And I mentioned it to Davinio and told him that Lippmann had suggested this. He says, of course, this is one of the experiments I've planned, and I'm sure it was. Mm-hmm. But he was sufficiently interested, you see, in what was going on to Lippmann to comment. But, for example, I certainly wasn't aware that he was writing that paper. And in fact, it was only after I got to St. Louis that I read that paper, that I was made aware of it. He wrote it in 1941, I believe, and this was 1946 when I went to St. Louis. But you see, the interest in Davinio's laboratory was not in phosphate compounds at all. As I told you, it was in sulfur compounds and acetylation and so on.
You went to St. Louis because your husband got a job. Okay. And in St. Louis, you were a research associate.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get paid? Corey's paid you?
Yes, of course.
Okay. But there, things were quite different because you must have had more freedom.
Oh, absolutely.
Your papers were... Did you negotiate that, or was that just the way their group was?
No, I mean, after all, I had been on a team for 8.5 years, and I didn't want to do that again. And so when I got... Well, when I had that discussion with Corey in New York, I told him some of the problems I would like to work on.
Mm-hmm.
One, I still remember what the problems were. One was this business of using O18 to find out about bond cleavage.
Right.
And the other was to use deuterium and tritium to see the isotope effect in enzymatic reactions. Now, after that interview, I didn't hear from him for a long time. I didn't know whether I'd have a job or not. I later found out when I got there that the reason he hadn't done anything about it is that he and Gertie Corey were offered jobs and were seriously considering leaving St. Louis, you see. So when they finally decided to stay, I remember this very well because I said to my husband, well, what am I going to do if I get there and I don't have a job? My husband had great confidence in me. He said, well, we have a little money saved up. You can work without pay for a year, and by that time I'm sure they'll give you a job. Well, anyhow, it didn't have to happen because we didn't have to do it that way because Corey did offer me a job.
Did you have children at that time?
Oh, I had two. I had two children while I was working for Davinio.
That was the next question I was going to ask you. How did you manage to juggle all this?
Well, it wasn't easy.
You really had...
I had to hire
family
people.
Was running two careers, and you were raising children.
That's right.
Oh, you just hired people to...
Look after my children. Yeah. It was not easy because, you see, both my children, the first two children, were born during World War II. And to get domestic help of any kind was very difficult. So, well, I did, but it wasn't easy.
So you had two early papers that had the Corey's name on them. I suppose those were sort of...
Well, No. Actually, the first paper I published was by myself from Corey's lab. I had presented these two possible problems to Corey, and he liked the O18 problem much better. So I told him that I'd have to build a mass spectrometer if I was going to do O18 work. And he said, okay. And he supplied the money for it, and he also supplied an electronics man for me to help with the circuits and so on. And so I built one there. But when I came there, they tried to get me to work with them. Gertie particularly, she was a very enthusiastic person. She would come and tell me all the wonderful problems they were doing, and I'd just say, no, no, I don't want to do that. I want to do my own thing. Well, they were very smart people, so after a few months of this, they realized I really meant it, and they just left me alone. And so I went ahead on my own. Once having done that and established it, I was quite willing to collaborate with them, you see. And so one day, oh, I also set up a radioactive isotope laboratory for them, because in 1946, they started making commercial instrumentation. I should tell you that we did a little bit with radioactive sulfur in the Vigneault's laboratory, and we had to build our own Geiger counter, you understand, and so on. But by the time, you know, I think we still in 1946, I still had to have the shop build me a Geiger counter, but a scaling circuit became available to do the actual counting. And since it was very new, a lot of this came out of Los Alamos, all these electronic things. And a lot of companies went into business when these things were made public. But I remember Nuclear Chicago, I bought a scaling circuit from them, and I realized I would be calling them every few days to tell them this didn't work or that didn't work. They'd say, try this, try that. And then I realized I was doing research for that company. Finally, I said, when you get all the bugs out of this thing, you can send me one. I'm sending this one back. But that's what it was like in those days. And at the same time, I started building a mass spectrometer. And Al Neer was great. He gave me the main part of it, which is the tube. And he had that built in his place. And he also let me use his mechanic to wind the magnet. Because, well, then the problem of getting copper then was very difficult. It was very difficult to get materials at that time. And I had learned...
This is already after the war.
Yes, this is right after the war. It took a couple of years till they caught up, you know, till things were easier. A year at least. But I've had one experience at Cornell. I built a mass spectrometer too. And at that time, Harry Thode in Canada, who had been in Urey's laboratory, we overlapped in Urey's laboratory. He was a postdoc when I was a graduate student. He became not only the head of the chemistry department at McMaster University, but he became president of the university.
That's T-H-O-D-E.
I think he's still alive. I saw him, the last time I saw him was at an ACS meeting about 5 years ago. Anyhow, I knew that he was building mass spectrums. This was during the war. And so I got in touch with him and asked him if he would give me a tube. And he said yes. And he sent it to me. And it was only partially finished. I had to finish this thing. And one of the things that too, this one was made of glass, but it had to have a metal shield on the inside. Not a shield, it was...
Reflector or something?
No, it was for the ions that hit the walls. You wanted them to have something conducting to take them away. So you had to have an inner thing. And he'd use stovepipe made of nichrome 5. And I decided that I want to use the green field cable, but of course it had to be non-magnetic. And I called up, I had the material, nichrome 5. I called up several companies in New York that made green field cable, and I just got them out of the phone book. And they'd say things, say, lady, don't you know there's a war on, and refuse me, you see. So I decided to call Anaconda Copper. And of course they did it for me and didn't refuse to take any money for it. So when I was in St. Louis and had this trouble getting copper, I just called out and come to copper. Again, I got it. You see, these big companies do this for just goodwill, you know. And so I learned my lesson. You go to the top. And I managed to get all the materials I needed that way. Anyhow, the one I built at in St. Louis was a very good one. The one that I built at Cornell never worked terribly well. But the one at, in St. Louis was excellent. I used it the whole time I was there, from 47, I guess I finished it, until 60 when I left.
Perhaps in New York you didn't have that much of a need, because there were all these other mass spectrometers around that you had access to.
It was that, you see, during the war, Neer had been improving the designs of mass spectrometers. So his design was really, in 46, was very much better than the one I had used. Mm-hmm. I mean, for example, for the voltage supply, I actually used storage batteries in Cornell because they hadn't designed a circuit that was stable enough. Mm-hmm. But during the war, all these things had been done. And so I knew Al Neer. I had a letter from him recently.
Yeah.
Anyhow, he gave me the tube, and he had his machine shop make me the magnet, which was, of course, a great help. But at Cornell, I had to do much more myself. I had to get this thing in. I had to make all the seals. I had to get the plates into the glass. He had just sent me the chamber, and I had to do a lot more. And I had to use my ingenuity, because there really wasn't anything available there to do these things. But I had friends, which was helpful.
Someplace or other, I had a question about the fact that you always seem relatively comfortable around large instruments. This goes on through your entire career, even when you go on to... And I thought to myself, gee, that's not very, quote, ladylike.
Uh-huh.
And do you think you inherited some of that from... you said your father was terrible with his hands. On the other hand, he did invent a...
Yes, but he was very inept. I mean, he couldn't do anything manually. And I'm pretty good. I mean, I'm pretty good at glass blowing, and I could put circuits together, too, and solder and so on.
Where do you think that came from?
Probably my mother. She was very good at embroidery and knitting and so on.
I wasn't. I thought, at what point in your career did you...
Always. I mean, don't forget that the job I had after I had my master's degree for 2 years was with engineers, and instrumentation was very important there, and I got to an appreciation of machine shop work and all the rest on that job. I devised my own equipment there, except for the recorder, which they had an instrument section that did nothing but design instruments. And I told them what I wanted, and they designed it.
Well, how would you characterize the differences between the laboratory Cornell and the one at St. Louis?
Oh, they were very different. Divinio's was a one-man show. This was not atypical, by the way, of medical schools at that time. The big shock came when I went from a university chemistry department to a medical school. Because most medical schools had only one full professor, the man at the top. And I wasn't used to that. You know, at Columbia, there were quite a few. Divinio didn't even have an associate professor in the department. He had two assistant professors whom he had inherited. Mm-hmm. The associate professor whom he had inherited left within a year. One of the assistant professors who stayed there a while, he left too about 4 or 5 years later. And the other assistant professor was brought into the group. So it was definitely a one-man department. And
this was now the Department of Biochemistry, or?
Yes, it was the Department of Biochemistry at Cornell Medical College. And everyone worked as a team. Well, in St. Louis it wasn't like that at all. First of all, there were Carl and Gertie, his wife, who worked together.
Right.
They also worked separately with postdocs and so on. Divino had a limited number of graduate students because there were no courses for them to take at a medical school. Cornell was pretty far away, so he wouldn't take anyone unless they had a master's degree. And in Corey's department, there were even fewer graduate students. There was maybe one a year. And it was hard to be a graduate student then because you were treated like a postdoc, you see. There was no group. So the only group were postdocs. So that was a difference. The other difference, it's very difference in, great difference in style. Even if people worked with Carl Corey or with Gertie Corey, it would be two names on a paper or three names on a paper, but not this business of everybody.
Right.
Each person who was a postdoc worked on a different problem. It wasn't this kind of a joint kind of thing that Divino had. And the assistant professors in the department were all independent. I mean, they weren't. It's true that Corey chose people. He once told me his philosophy of a small department. He didn't cover all of biochemistry in the department. He only covered carbohydrates, and he covered everything from enzymes to isolation and purification, to physical aspects of the proteins, and so on. I mean, in the department, there were people who covered this. But he wanted a department where everyone could talk to everyone else, and that was his idea, rather than having someone working on nucleic acids and someone else working on lipids and so on. He, as far as the research was concerned, believed in, if you had a small department, there were only about 9 faculty members, to keep it all so that everyone could talk to everyone else. That was his philosophy. But as I say, the assistant professors certainly were completely independent, though they worked in an area that he was interested in. And since he had purified so many enzymes, if they were interested in the physical chemistry of those things, they usually worked on those enzymes, obviously, because the material was available. And there was a very different, I mean, you know, the laboratory in St. Louis was very international. People from all over the world came there. One of the reasons was that, first of all, it was a very outstanding laboratory, but another reason was that in 1946, when the war was over, many of these foreigners didn't have any place to work. You know, their labs were destroyed or certainly unused and so on. So they came to this country for a year or two. And it was like a UN there, as far as the composition of the people was concerned.
Who was providing support? The Corys just.
By the way, Divino's support came from the Rockefeller Foundation originally. And when I left, he got a grant from the American Cyanamid Company with no strings attached, $500,000. That was 1946. That was a small fortune. I never knew where, I mean, Corey never told me, but I was told that he got his money, most of it, from Eli Lilly. See, he was interested in carbohydrate metabolism, insulin, diabetes, and so on, which, of course, Eli Lilly was interested in. And I was told that they sent him a personal check every year for $100,000. I should also tell you that at that time, Washington University Medical School was really quite a remarkable place. They put research ahead of everything else in that school, and had for many years. And they had a so-called full-time system in the clinical departments. That is, you worked for a salary. You didn't collect from patients. The school collected from patients. And 20% of the take of the clinical departments was turned back to the preclinical departments for research.
Certainly. Enlightened administration.
Yes. It was an unusual place. They really agonized over appointing even an assistant professor. They had the senior professors, that is the chairman of all the departments, form the executive committee, and they actually used to read the papers of the candidates. And they were the ones who decided. This was all in the preclinical departments.
Mm-hmm.
They were the ones who decided whether you could hire this assistant professor in this department.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they believed that's how they could keep up standards.
Yeah. You mentioned the fact that people in Davinio's group were like a team, and I noticed that almost all the papers you had from there also had a fellow named Joe Chandler.
Yeah, he was that assistant professor who was Glackenschalter, as I used to say.
Okay. And Sophia Simons was another.
Uh-huh. She was a graduate student.
I see.
She's Joe Fruton's wife.
Oh.
There's a book in biochemistry by Fruton.
Fruton Simons, I'm sure, of course. Made that connection.
Mm-hmm. Joe worked across the street at Rockefeller at that time.
Did any of your children go into science?
Mm-hmm. My son. My daughters get angry when I say they're not scientists. They're both psychologists, but they're clinical psychologists. So. But my son is he got a PhD actually in biochemistry.
Mm-hmm.
He's now an associate professor at the University of Connecticut Medical Center. He happens to be in the physiology department. And I guess he's a cell biologist. I don't know what, you know these distinctions. But he got his PhD with Paul Berg at Stanford in biochemistry.
Mm-hmm. Did you discuss scientific problems with your husband?
Our fields are pretty far apart.
Yes. And yet you often collaborate with people in the physics departments and
well,
those.
Yeah. Yes, we used to, well, I mean, I found out about NMR and EPR because of the fact that my husband was in an apartment where that was a very actively pursued field.
Let's go back. We'll get to that in just a minute. So,
certainly used my husband. If I wanted to know anything in physics, he was the most knowledgeable person in physics. I mean, he was rare in that he knew all fields of physics. In fact, the graduate students here loved it. He, at one time for a few years, gave a course before they took the qualifying exam. He used to give a course on the highlights of physics and cover the whole field. He has taught every course in the book. So he was an excellent person to use as a consultant.
Mm-hmm.
And I never hesitated if I had a problem to ask him about it.
Mm-hmm.
Though he used to, in recent years, he said, I don't know anything about NMR. Okay. He said that, but in fact he published a very fundamental paper that had, as an example, NMR. On the equation of state or something in statistical mechanics.
Mm-hmm. Your first solo paper from Washington was what I term almost a classical physical organic paper.
That's right.
Hydrolysis of glucose 1-phosphate.
That, by the way, was called the Cori ester. They discovered that compound.
Oh, the
glucose 1-phosphate.
I see. Okay. And using both acid and enzymic catalysis. Tell me a little bit about the origins of that work. I mean, you'd obviously thought about it before you went.
Oh, yes. I had always thought, as I told you, my thesis work was on 018 at that time. There were many, many organic reactions that I thought one could learn something about mechanism from by using 018. And, of course, I knew that the Cori laboratory was an enzyme. You know, they were outstanding enzymologists in the country. And so when I went there, I thought, here's my chance to apply this to biochemical reactions or enzymatic reactions. And that was the origin of it. And Corey was very pleased with that. He was also interested in mechanism. And so I was, when I went there, I started reading their papers, and I realized that no one knew where glucose 1-phosphate was split, though it is, of course, the substrate to form glycogen. Actually, it has since been found out that it's the breakdown pathway of glycogen, not the synthesis. At the time, they thought it was the pathway of synthesis, but it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
But
we have to